On our last program, I suggested you read two books. One was Give Me Liberty by Jerry Spence, and the other was Secrets of the Federal Reserve by Eustace Mullins. Because of our time limitations, I did not tell you anything about the two authors, but now I'm going to. I never met Jerry Spence, but he is the trial lawyer who successfully defended Randy Weaver in the Ruby Ridge, Idaho fiasco. I have always respected him for that and for his values. Spence is now in his middle 80s and is semi-retired, but in his long, illustrious career, he never once lost a criminal case, either as a prosecutor or as a defense lawyer. Eustace Mullins is now deceased, and I did have the pleasure to meet and speak with him a few times. He must have had a photographic mind. If he was asked a question about anything, he would never stammer, but would come up with the dates, the names, and the locations on almost any subject. He was the same whether he was speaking from the podium or just carrying on a normal conversation with a person. Neither I nor anyone that I ever heard of heard him swear or even use any kind of slang in his conversation. Eustace was a native of Virginia. He was a true Southern gentleman, a real class act. He could not find a publisher for the first edition of his book, Secrets of the Federal Reserve, but two private individuals using their own capital did get a small edition published in 1952. In 1955, Guido Rader brought out a German edition. 10,000 books were printed in Germany, and 10,000 books were seized and burned in Germany. This was the first book burned in Germany after the end of World War II. I don't know if any other books have been burned since then. I guess this shows you how alarmed the powers that be are of this book. On our last program, we talked all about the Rothschild dynasty. We did the entire program on this family because they came into prominence during the same century this country became a nation. In doing so, we interrupted our chronological history of money. We left you two programs ago with the War of 1812. So far, in this thesis, we have tried to explain that the First Bank of the United States was the design of the Federalist. William Pitt said that if we did acquire a debt funding scheme and banking system, our boasted independence will be a mere phantom. The bank had a charter for 20 years and expired in 1811. Congress refused to renew the bank's charter, and we had a war with England in 1812. After both sides declared peace, the Second Bank of the United States was established in 1816 with a charter of 20 years. I hope these facts raised questions in your mind. For instance, was William Pitt correct? Were we really free of Britain after we launched the First Bank of the United States, a private bank? Since we went to war with Britain within 1 year of the termination of the First Bank of the United States, does the government tell the bank what to do, or does the private bank tell the government what to do? Well, those are a couple of questions. Draw your own conclusions. Let's talk a little bit about the Second Bank of the United States now. This bank's often referred to as the Bank from Hell. Selling shares in the Second Bank of the United States sounds almost like selling the shares for the First Bank of the United States. Shares were sold on the installment plan. One-third of the total amount was to be paid on each installment in gold. The first installment was made in gold, but the second and third installments were accepted in IOUs from state chartered banks. The second and third installments were never made. The gold requirement was just a masquerade. William Jones was appointed as president of the Second Bank of the United States. William Jones had previously been an ineffective Treasury Secretary. Ralph Catterall wrote that in his person, helpless inefficiency was placed in control of government finances. From April to July 1817, 19 branch offices had been formed, $52 million in loans on its books, and $9 million in circulating currency was also created based on gold and silver coin reserves of $2.5 million. This shows its reserves were only 4.1%. Approximately 60% of these loans were made in the Philadelphia and Baltimore areas. With expansion like this, speculation was extensive. Then, in typical bank fashion, what happened? Well, in April of 1818, the bank started contracting its money supply. In January 1819, Jones was replaced by Langdon Chavez, who continued the contraction. Outstanding loans and advances went from a high of $52 million down to $12 million. Circulating notes dropped from $10 million down to $3.5 million. There were a considerable amount of bankruptcies throughout the nation. Real estate and other assets that had been pledged as collateral for the loans were seized, with sheriff's sales everywhere. A public outrage arose as farmers and artisans were dispossessed of their life's work. In 1823, Nicholas Biddle replaced Chavez as he was elected president of the bank. Biddle had been a child prodigy. He finished studies at the University of Pennsylvania at the age of 13 in Greek classics. Originally, Biddle had refused to become a director of the bank, but President Monroe pressed him to accept, and he did so out of a sense of duty. He did run the bank more prudently than Jones had. The citizens of the United States had accepted the First Bank of the United States, but they were not so forgiving of the Second Bank of the United States. The state of Georgia sued the bank for removing coinage from circulation. The governor demanded that the bank replace the coinage with enough circulating medium to supply the real wants of the citizens. The chairman of the state legislative committee of North Carolina wrote that the actions of the bank to ruin state banks and individuals constituted the greatest crime in years. In 1818, the state of Illinois prohibited any but state-chartered banks within the state, and they put that right in their constitution. The states of Georgia, Kentucky, Maryland, Ohio, North Carolina, Tennessee, and Pennsylvania imposed taxes on the branches of the Second Bank. Records of banks prior to 1832 are very scarce or non-existent. Many banks were located in inaccessible places, some deep in the forest, others on some remote prairie where it would be extremely difficult to find the offices where the notes were payable. Stock of coinage was insignificant and was moved from bank to bank to meet the inspector's visits. In 1825, a group of larger Boston banks tried to limit the excessive issue of notes by country banks. They sent notes issued by remote country banks back for immediate collection unless the country banks kept a real deposit with this group of banks. They called themselves the Suffolk Group. In 1829, while Van Buren was governor of New York, New York introduced what it called a safety fund system to better protect the state-chartered bank's depositors. Each bank was required to pay 0.5% of its capital to the state treasury until it had paid a total of 3%. The fund was used to redeem notes issued by failed banks and limited the notes banks issued to 2 times their capital. New York was the only state to do this, even though the system worked well. During the period called the Free Banking Period, which was pre-1836, not after 1836, as some libertarians advocate. After 1836, banking regulations became more rigorous, but the term free banking was used because the requirement for a special legislative act establishing each new bank was removed. At this time, Hezekiah Niles wrote, "The imagination of an honest man can hardly conceive the stupendous villainies that have been contrived by the banks." Another writer, William Gudge, wrote that the bank system is the principal cause of all social evil in the United States. People cannot distinguish the causes, but men have come to see the wealth passing continually out of the hands of those whose labor produced it or whose economy saved it into the hands of those who neither work nor save. William Gudge had been the editor and publisher of the Journal of Banking. He had also written a short history of paper money and banking in 1833. In this book, he gave several examples of banking practices. Here are some of them. One point he brought out is that of banking capital. "Most folks," he said, "think that when they hear of a bank having $1 or $2 million in capital, they have real money in this amount. They don't. The capital of banks consists of promissory notes of individuals. The banks got these notes from stockholders by giving them promissory notes of the banks. So bank capital are formed by exchanging one kind of promise to pay for another kind of promise to pay. The whole transaction is between the bank and the stockholders." He also alleged that manipulating bank stock shares became easier after the New York Stock Exchange was open in March of 1817. He held that when a charter for a bank is granted, the speculators make a big show of their desire to possess the stock, creating the idea that the stock is valuable. They subscribe to more shares than are being offered. They hire big roughnecks to get shares for them. These ruffians struggle violently at the windows to give and receive personal injury. "These doings," he said, "have their effect on simple-minded people, and these people prefer bank stock to land and houses. The losses suffered by simple-minded people is enormous. In just 19 years, from 1811 to 1830, over 160 banks went broke. You seldom see an identified bank or a money corporation candidate running for office, but when questions arise which affect them, the banks have agents at work whose operations are the more effective because they are unseen. Few journalists can venture to expose the money corporation system in such plain terms as everybody would understand without risking losing their jobs. Many newspaper editors, far from being independent, are in debt to the banks. Despite our boasted liberty in the United States, a free and full explanation of the principal cause of our social evils would not be tolerated. It is public credit that support the banks, and not the banks that support public credit. The deposits of the banks are the property of the community generally, and as the profits derived from circulation come from the community generally, they ought to go to the community generally and be used to lighten the burdens of taxation." That's the end of some points Gudge made in his book, A History of Paper Money in the United States. Let's continue now with the history of the Second Bank of the United States. When this contraction of money took place, The South and West were especially hit hard, and this panic, as it was called, was probably a contributing factor causing the Civil War. A Pennsylvania commission was led by the economist Conde Ragged, who condemned the banks. Many discussions followed, but the debates were never over whether a private company should be allowed to control the nation's money system. The question was deflected with the uproar and stage-managed arguments over whether an inflationary policy or a sound money policy should be followed. Andrew Jackson had told Nicholas Biddle in a letter that he had been afraid of banks ever since he had read the history of the South Seas Bubble. He had some of his economically minded associates come up with a plan of a national bank of issue, but after 5 months, they failed to come up with any proposal. In 1832, the Baring Brothers Bank of England was holding 3% bonds that were the last of the Revolutionary War debt. The Second Bank of the United States had the government funds that were supposed to be used to redeem those bonds. The Second Bank of the United States held on to the funds, allowing the bank to earn 7% on the money while paying Baring Brothers 3% on the bonds. This infuriated Andrew Jackson no little and then some. It was the first event that triggered Andrew Jackson's confrontation with the bank. Another event which exacerbated the conflict was when a French government check to the United States government for $961,240 bounced. The U.S. Treasury returned the money to the bank and offered to pay the actual cost involved, but the bank demanded and actually deducted 15% of the amount of the check from the government's accounts. That's $144,186 the bank collected from the United States government for a temporary bad check from the French government. The United States government had to sue in order to get their money back, but didn't collect the money until 1847. Jackson had intended to just let the bank's charter expire during his second term in office, but the bank was purchasing congressional support, and the fact that Jackson knew if he vetoed the act renewing the charter, his veto could be overridden. The fight between Jackson and the bank became quite brutal. At one point, David Gulliver wrote to Biddle. He said that all hope is now in bribery. Senator Benton estimated that the bank spent $3 million bribing senators, members of the House of Representatives, and editors of newspapers in order to acquire their support for rechartering the bank. The Washington Telegraph newspaper ceased to oppose. The New York Courier had been a bitter opponent, but became an active supporter. A $15,000 loan, then a $20,000 loan, then another $15,000 loan did it. Biddle paid Daniel Webster $32,000 in loans, then stopped. Daniel wrote him a note saying, "I believe my retainer has not been renewed or refreshed as usual. If it be wished that my relation to the bank should be continued, it may be well to send the usual retainers. Yours with regard, Daniel Webster." That's interesting because Daniel Webster once said, "Of all the contrivances for cheating the laboring classes of mankind, none has been more effective than that which deludes them with paper money." Knowing that Daniel Webster was being paid by the bank, and knowing that the bank was against the government making the government's paper money legal tender, don't you wonder what Daniel Webster's real reason for making that statement was? Congress voted to recharter the bank in July 1832. This was the same day Van Buren, Jackson's vice president, returned from England, and Jackson had taken to bed. He had overtaxed his strength. While lying in bed, Jackson grabbed Van Buren's hand with one of his own, while passing the other hand through his white hair, and Jackson said, "The bank, Mr. Van Buren, is trying to kill me, but I will kill it." Van Buren told Jackson that he hoped Jackson would veto the bill. Jackson did veto the bank's recharter. Jackson's veto message was long as he explained in great detail why he vetoed the bank's recharter. He pointed out that the bank's monopoly was unfair and calculated its value in millions of dollars. He also pointed out that of the $28 million in private stock in the corporation, $8,405,000 were held by foreigners, mostly from Great Britain. Does this make you wonder again if our independence from Britain is real or just a charade? Daniel Webster answered Jackson's veto message with a message of his own supporting the bank. If the public had known how much Biddle was paying Webster, would the public have paid any attention at all to Webster's message? On January 30th, as Jackson was leaving a congressional funeral held in the House chamber of the Capitol, Richard Lawrence shot at Jackson. The gun misfired. The 67-year-old president repeatedly clubbed Lawrence with his walking cane, and bystanders wrestled Lawrence to the ground. One of the bystanders was Congressman Davy Crockett. During the scuffle, Lawrence pulled out another pistol and shot Jackson, but it too misfired, maybe because of wet powder. In the 1930s, researchers at the Smithsonian Institute test-fired the pistols. Both of them discharged normally on the first try. Lawrence was tried and found innocent by reason of insanity. The prosecuting attorney was Francis Scott Key, the composer of the Star-Spangled Banner. Supposedly, Lawrence thought Jackson was keeping money from him that the government owed him, and with that money, he planned to return to England and take his rightful place as King Richard III. Jackson always thought that his enemies in the Whig Party had hired Lawrence to assassinate him. Lawrence had just recently returned from England. Jackson's first vice president was John C. Calhoun. They had become bitter enemies, and Jackson always suspected that Calhoun was one of the people behind his assassination attempt. Lawrence died in a mental hospital in 1861. After Jackson had vetoed the bill rechartering the bank, Jackson instructed the Secretary of the Treasury, Louis McLean, to start removing government money from the Second Bank of the United States. McLean refused. Jackson fired him and replaced McLean with William Duane. Duane refused. Jackson replaced him with the Attorney General, Roger Tansey. Tansey followed the President's order. Slowly, he began pulling all $7 million out of the Second Bank of the United States and deposited it in state and local banks. Jackson also replaced the bank's board, but the Senate refused to confirm the new appointees on the grounds that they wanted too much information about the bank's affairs. At the same time Jackson was pulling the government's money out of the bank, Biddle was contracting the nation's money supply. From August 1833 to February 1834, he called in over $18 million in loans. Some historians wonder if the challenge to Biddle's power may have affected his mind because of some of his rash statements. Statements such as, quote, "The prospects of the bank are, I think, favorable. The state of the country is so bad and gets worse daily. I do not see how things can hold on in this way much longer. Congress will have to act soon. Also, he said, my course is decided. All the other banks and all the other merchants may break, but the Bank of the United States shall not break. There is a famous quote attributed to Jackson in a speech he gave before Congress in 1836, in which he supposedly says, as he was speaking of the Second Bank of the United States, "You are a den of vipers and thieves. I intend to rout you out, and by the grace of the eternal God, I will rout you out." If that was the origin of the quote, it went unnoticed for over 90 years. The first recorded appearance of this quote appears when it was published in a pamphlet entitled Andrew Jackson and the Bank of the United States by Stan Hinkles. He was an auctioneer and collector of Americana. The pamphlet was first published in 1928. Jackson's second vice president was Martin Van Buren. Van Buren, like Jackson, fought against bank privileges throughout his career. He proposed legislation limiting bankers' powers. Van Buren succeeded Jackson as the eighth president of the United States from 1837 to 1841. Van Buren started the movement to do away with debtors' prison. In 1840, Van Buren established 15 sub-treasury branches to handle government money. In his parlor in his home, there are only three portraits, one of himself, one of Jackson, and one of Jefferson. All three men were against the bankers' powers. Although, like Jackson, Van Buren was not successful in instituting the money power into the government of the nation, he was successful in removing it from the private bankers, but not forever. In 1836, the government had started making and receiving all payments in coinage or truly convertible bank notes. They started this by subscriptions for public lands. This was the period when our government came the closest to put into operation a truly gold-silver monetary standard. This happened during Van Buren's administration. Van Buren really cared for this country. But going to the mostly metallic monetary system caused the worst depression this country had suffered up to that time. As usual, there was not enough gold and silver in the land to satisfy the needs of a country growing economically and expanding in population. Doesn't this show once again that a money system's success or failure is not measured by the value of a piece of metal? It certainly doesn't matter when your farm or your factory or your job disappears in a monetarily created depression. The system has failed. Doesn't this show also that it is not the amount of gold in a dollar, but the amount of dollar in the gold? Once state bank notes were not accepted by the government, their circulation was cut back considerably. As soon as the bank had lost its federal charter, it was rechartered as a Pennsylvania corporation. This bank suspended payment in 1839 and later liquidated in 1841 during a cotton trading fiasco. Biddle was indicted, but not convicted of defrauding shareholders who lost everything. At the end of Jackson's term in office, the Second Bank of the United States did not exist. But the fight over who would control the money system of the United States was still ongoing. The clock says we're out of time. Catch you next time. Bye-bye.